Good morning, church. One Christmas Sunday morning, a certain pastor decided to visit the preschool Sunday school at her church. So the class's teacher had each child draw a picture of some aspect of the Christmas story, and then she put them up on the wall so that the preacher could come and look at them, look them over. The pastor was impressed as she identified the meaning of each drawing. Over here was a picture of a barn with a man and a woman standing next to a manger. Got it? And another picture showed some sheep and men in a field and some angels up in the sky. Yeah, pretty clear. A third picture showed some camels crossing the desert and a bright star up in the sky. Yeah, got that one too. But there was one picture that kind of puzzled her. The child had drawn an airplane with three figures in the back and one up front. The pastor thought and thought about this one. She said, "I'm afraid I just don't get this one." So the preschool artist spoke up and she said, "Well, that's the Holy Family's flight to Egypt." "Well, okay," said the pastor, "that must be the Holy Family in the back, Jesus, Mary, and Joseph. But who's that up front?" Wait for it. "Oh, that's Pontius, the pilot." You know, I thought I should start today's sermon with something a little lighthearted, given that rather dark reading that we just heard. This story is often called the Slaughter of the Innocents, the massacre by King Herod of the male children of Bethlehem. This is one of the darkest incidents described in the Gospels, though not the only one, of course. But coming as it does, right at the end of the nativity narrative, it's a bit jarring, isn't it? It's particularly jarring if we read it, as we're doing today, in Advent, even before Christmas. We're still decorating the tree, addressing the Christmas cards, wrapping the presents, waiting in anticipation of the glorious events of Christmas morning. And here we are confronted with this disturbing tale of babies being murdered by a tyrant, intent on preserving his own power by wiping out any potential rivals. So what does this story have to say to us? Well, I'll get to that in a few moments. But first, let me remind you, as Karen did earlier, that we're in the midst of an Advent sermon series based on a little book by Matt Rawl called The Redemption of Scrooge. And Rawl's book, in turn, is based on that beloved Charles Dickens classic, A Christmas Carol. 2 weeks ago, Reverend Karen began our series by introducing us to the story and the visit by the ghost of Jacob Marley to his former business partner, Ebenezer Scrooge. And then last week, she focused on Scrooge's encounter with the ghost of Christmas past. This week, I'm tackling Scrooge's meeting with the ghost of Christmas present. You know, I've got to say that A Christmas Carol is one of my all-time favorite stories. I've read the book at least three times, and I watch the movies every year, whether Scrooge is played by Alistair Sim or Reginald Owen, George C. Scott, Mr. Magoo, or any of a dozen other actors. It's such a timeless story, and it seems to have a profound effect on people, doesn't it? For example, after reading the book, Robert Louis Stevenson wrote to a friend, quote, "I want to go out and comfort someone. I shall never listen to the nonsense they tell about not giving money. I shall give money. Not that I haven't done so always, but I shall do it with a high hand now," unquote. The wife of historian and philosopher Thomas Carlyle said that the visions of Scrooge had so worked on her husband's imagination that he had, quote, "been seized with a perfect convulsion of hospitality," and it actually insisted on improvising two dinner parties with only a day between, unquote. The Queen of Norway once sent gifts to disabled children in London signed with Tiny Tim's love. and an American industrialist, having heard Dickens' own reading of the book one Christmas Eve, was so inspired that he closed his factory the following day and somehow managed to get a turkey to every one of his workers. Shades of Ebenezer Scrooge. Apparently, this little book, actually one of five Christmas stories that Dickens wrote, has sparked changes in many who have read it, sometimes momentous, generous changes, a little like the story of Scrooge himself. So let's get back to that story. Scrooge's third ghostly visitor is the ghost of Christmas present. You know, in 1843, when Scrooge published his book, Santa Claus had not yet gained popularity. But our ghost is a little like Santa. He's a big, jovial character in a colorful costume bordered with white fur. He wears a holly wreath on his head. And when Scrooge first encounters him, he's surrounded by the trappings of Christmas, evergreens, mistletoe, ivy. And he's seated on a couch made of roasts and cakes and fruits and other seasonal foods in wonderful variety. True to form, he takes Scrooge on a tour of places far and wide, homes, hospitals, lighthouses, ships at sea. And in even the poorest and most disadvantaged of places, they find the joy and the contentment of the Christmas season. Dickens writes, quote, "Much they saw and far they went, and many homes they visited, but always with a happy end. The spirits stood beside sick beds, and they were cheerful. On foreign lands, and they were close at home. By struggling men, and they were patient in the greater hope. By poverty, and it was rich." Unquote. They visit the home of Scrooge's nephew, Fred, where a party is taking place. And even though Scrooge had been quite rude to his nephew the previous day, and all present agree that he's a miserable old miser, Fred toasts his uncle's health. They also visit the home of Scrooge's clerk, Bob Cratchit. And despite the Cratchit's poverty, due in large part to Scrooge's own miserliness, and even in the face of the precarious health of the Cratchit's youngest son, Tiny Tim, they find there a festive scene of intimacy, happiness, and joy, the joy that Scrooge had disdained. And Scrooge begins to understand what he's been missing by his own neglect of Christmas. And he comes to see that not only does he have it within his own power to make a difference in his world, but he has a responsibility to do so. He asks the spirit if Tiny Tim will live, but the spirit tells him, quote, "I see a vacant seat in the poor chimney corner and a crutch without an owner, carefully preserved. If these shadows remain unaltered by the future, the child will die," unquote. And then he stings Scrooge with his own words. If he'd be like to die, he'd better do it and decrease the surplus population. Near the end, the very end of the visit, Scrooge observes beneath the spirit's flowing robe two gaunt and dirty children, a boy and a girl. He describes them this way: yellow, meager, ragged, scowling, wolfish, but prostrate too in their humility. No change, no degradation, no perversion of humanity in any grade. Through all the mysteries of wonderful creation has monsters half so horrible and dread, unquote. The boy is ignorance, says the spirit, and the girl is want. Beware them both, he says, in all of their degrees, but most of all beware the boy. For on his brow I see that written which is doom, unless the writing be erased, unquote. And with this dreadful image, the spirit is gone. Now, I don't think I'm spoiling it for anyone to say that following the visits by Marley and the three Christmas spirits, Scrooge has a great change of heart. He turns over a new leaf. He gives away a lot of money and a turkey. He reconciles with his uncle. He helps his hapless clerk, Bob Cratchit, with his family. Tiny Tim doesn't die after all. And all's well with the world. God bless us, everyone. Well, not quite. Because here's the thing. Scrooge is just one person. Despite his change of heart, his ensuing generosity, his assistance to the Cratchits, there's only so much that one person can do. Despite Scrooge's redemption, the prisons and the workhouses of his day still continued very much in operation. Grinding poverty was still the order of the day for many in his time. And I assume that the specters of ignorance and want were still hanging around under the robes of the next ghost of Christmas present, and every one of his successors up to the present day. Because even 180 years after Dickens published his novel, the world is still cursed with ignorance and want, war, poverty, injustice. So did it really make a difference? Does Christmas make a difference? Well, let's get back to the nativity story. We know the outcome of that story, don't we? After all, we retell it every year at this time. But sometimes we forget that the participants didn't know how it would all turn out. Mary, the uneducated peasant girl, was asked to bear a child under the very real danger that she would be rejected by her prospective husband, maybe even stoned to death by her community. And then there's Joseph, whose fiancée is discovered to be pregnant with a child that's not his. How hurt and betrayed he must have felt. And after they got past that, Joseph and the very pregnant Mary are subjected to an arduous journey to Bethlehem, only to find no room at the inn, having to give birth in a dirty stable surrounded by animals. You know, we tend to romanticize the nativity stories, forgetting the terror, hardship, and anguish that these very real and very human individuals must have felt, uncertain how it would all turn out. We rightfully celebrate and recall the angel's announcement, "Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace to those on whom God's favor rests." Forgetting, perhaps, that for the participants there would have been very little peace. Certainly not for the exhausted teenage mother tending a newborn infant. Not for the confused husband caring for a child that was not his. And now we learn that the child is under a death sentence from King Herod. An angel is bringing to Joseph a disturbing message. "Get up and take the child and his mother," the angel says, "and flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you. For Herod is about to search for the child to kill him." And contrary to the vision of our preschool artist, remember her, it's not a short flight on a DC-10 to Cairo International. It's some 200 miles through difficult and hostile terrain on foot or on the back of a donkey, tending an infant and hauling their meager possessions. And this to escape a murderous tyrant bent on killing the child and not above killing other innocent children to accomplish his goal. With today's reading, Matthew is kind of giving us a splash of cold water in the face. Come back to reality, he seems to be saying. We may spend Advent and Christmas reveling in Bethlehem and babies, O Holy Night and away in a manger. We'll light our candles on Christmas Eve, serenaded by a heavenly choir of angels. We might be tempted to fall under the spell of Christmas and get the idea that the coming of the Christ child has somehow eliminated evil from the world. But now we're drawn back to reality. The murderous Herod, the slaughter of the innocent children, the hasty departure into the unknown. And we're reminded that Christmas does not eliminate suffering, certainly not for the participants and not for us. We're reminded that the forces of evil are powerful and a real danger to innocence and justice. But then we don't really have to be reminded of that, do we? We're reminded of it every day in a thousand different ways. When Russia rains death and destruction on the citizens in the Ukraine winter, another slaughter of the innocents. When a young man in Colorado Springs opens fire in a gay nightclub and kills 5 and injures 19 others. When 40 years after the first cases, folks are still dying of AIDS. When we see thousands suffering in the streets of Sudan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and 100 other places around the world, often from religious hatred. The atrocities arrive so regularly that we become almost numb to the suffering. Despite the coming of the Lord in the form of that baby, whose birth we celebrate in a few weeks on Christmas morning, there's no end to the hatred and suffering in the world. So what's gone wrong? Shouldn't the coming of the Messiah have put an end to evil? Or does the presence of so much evil and suffering in the world tell us that we've been mistaken all along about the coming of the Redeemer? You know, there's an old story about a Jewish teacher whose student one day comes to him and says, "Rabbi, I've heard rumors that the Messiah has come. Can this be true?" And the rabbi says to his students, "Go to that window and tell me the first thing you see." So the student does as he's commanded, and he reports, "I see a man beating a donkey." "Then," says the rabbi, "the Messiah has not come." In that view, as long as there's depravity and suffering in the world, then the Messiah can't have come, because the Messiah will put an end to all suffering and pain, even for that poor donkey. That was the expectation of many who waited centuries for the coming of the Messiah, and some who still do. But you know, that's not the Christian view. As Christians, we believe that Jesus was the Messiah, in spite of all the suffering and evil that remains. For Jesus never claimed that his coming would bring an end to suffering and hardship, and it obviously didn't. Elsewhere in Matthew's gospel, Jesus says, "Do not think that I have come to bring peace on the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but the sword." Once again, God has surprised us. God has done the unexpected and manifest God's self in a way that no one would have predicted. As today's reading reminds us, Jesus came into a world filled with suffering and hardship. And suffering, hardship, and evil remain even today, as we know from our own bitter experience. But if God never intended for Jesus' coming to end suffering and pain, what then? Well, I propose that the plan all along was for Jesus to show us how to confront evil with love and with the promise that Jesus would be with us there in the midst of it. Jesus doesn't eliminate our suffering. He builds a home with us in our pain. He weeps with us over rejection. He knows our loneliness and disillusionment. He experiences death as we do. Christmas is a testimony that the coming of the Christ did not eliminate evil and suffering, but rather that God came to be alongside us to share in our pain, to be with us as we confront suffering whenever we encounter it, to be with us as we confront evil with goodness, to be with us as we confront hatred with love, to teach us to love even as Jesus loved. So no, the redemption and the efforts of one person, whether it's Ebenezer Scrooge or you or I, isn't going to solve all the world's problems. There will still be ignorance and want in the world. There will still be war, poverty, injustice. Even Jesus said, "The poor you will always have with you." But that doesn't mean that the actions of one person or one group of people doesn't matter. For all his good intentions, Scrooge couldn't end poverty, suffering, and injustice in his world any more than we can end them in ours. But that doesn't mean that Scrooge didn't change his world for the better. As Dickens writes, he became as good a friend, as good a master, and as good a man as the good old city knew. Because of his generosity, a few needy folks received Christmas cheer. Because of his transformation, his nephew gained a better uncle. Bob Cratchit got a well-deserved raise and a much better boss. Tiny Tim gained a second father, and he didn't die. And all that counts for something, doesn't it? Predictably, there were those who made light of Scrooge's transformation. As Dickens puts it, some people laughed to see the alteration in him, but he let them laugh and little heeded them, for he was wise enough to know that nothing ever happened in this globe for good at which some people did not have their fill of laughter in the outset, unquote. And it's the same with each of us, isn't it? Each of us is called to do our part, to be as good a friend, as good a citizen, as good a person, as good a Christian as we can be. And no, we can't solve all the problems of the world, but we can make our little part of it better, a better place. And we can't control how other people view our actions, but does that really matter? I'd like to end this morning with a poem. It's a poem that I've always loved, and I think it sums up the message of my sermon pretty well, and maybe even some of the lessons of Christmas and of Ebenezer Scrooge. You've probably heard this poem. It's a poem by Kent Keith that reportedly was inscribed on the wall of Mother Teresa's children's home in Calcutta. And it's actually called The Paradoxical Commandments, but you may know it by the name Anyway. People are often unreasonable, illogical, and self-centered. Forgive them anyway. If you are kind, people may accuse you of selfish, ulterior motives. Be kind anyway. If you are successful, you will win some false friends and some true enemies. Succeed anyway. If you are honest and frank, people may cheat you. Be honest and frank anyway. What you spend years building, someone could destroy overnight. Build anyway. If you find serenity and happiness, they may be jealous. Be happy anyway. The good you do today, people will often forget tomorrow. Do good anyway. Give the world the best you have, and it may never be enough. Give the world the best you've got anyway. You see, in the final analysis, it's between you and your God. It was never between you and them anyway. God bless us, everyone, Uprising. Amen.